The Debate.
And welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Another minority being killed in the U.S. by police, unfortunately, is a normal headline in that country. Black Americans are 3.2 times more likely to get killed by police. And according to the New York Times, since March the 29th, at least 64 people have died at the hands of law enforcement nationwide, with Black and Latinos representing more than half of the dead. As of Saturday, the average was more than three killings per day. What is going on in the United States?
An analysis of gun violence from various databases shows police killings of individuals keep rising in the U.S., with the majority of victims being minorities. According to the analysis published by the New York Times, at least 64 people have died at the hands of law enforcement nationwide since March 29th. It also shows that Black and Latino people represent more than half of those killed, with an average over three victims a day. Analysts believe the U.S. justice system is gripped by a systematic crisis.
There is a systemic crisis in the U.S. in general for justice because you can see it clearly just within the police brutality against Black people, but also against working class white folk as well. Let's not forget that.
The U.S. has been the scene of protests in the past week over the killing of 20-year-old African-American Dante Wright in Minnesota. The unarmed man was killed on April 11th after a white police officer attempted to take him into custody for traffic violation. Anger boiled further following the release of a body cam video showing police fatally shooting a 13-year-old Hispanic boy.
Please stop! Stop right now! Hey, show me your f***ing hands! Stop it! Stop it! Shot fired! Get an ambulance up here now!
Adam Toledo was shot in the chest by a police officer in Chicago on March 29. Analysts believe the police's killing of minorities has become an epidemic in the U.S.
I think that what we're seeing with the death of Dante Wright in Minneapolis and all the many deaths that have taken place in the last year, the last 5 years, 10 years, roughly 1,000 every year of police killings of Black and brown men, mostly men, is an epidemic, and it's become absolutely—it's intolerable, and the police are out of control.
Anti-racism sentiments were already high in the U.S. over the trial of a former Minneapolis police officer charged with the murder of African American George Floyd. The trial began on March 30th and is ongoing. Floyd's death at the hands of a white officer last May raised calls for police reforms in the U.S. Racial discrimination and injustice against minorities there has long been a major concern. Prominent rights group Human Rights Watch recently warned that American authorities should take bold steps to address the structural racism in the police. Many have warned that the failure to tackle race issues will further ignite tensions and increase inequality in America.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, Dr. Gail Frazier, author, lecturer, and social entrepreneur out of Chicago, and Wyatt Reed, correspondent out of Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being with us. I'm going to start it off in D.C., and Wyatt. Wyatt, what exactly is going on? I mean, we're seeing this, of course, it never really came to an end, but last year, after the demonstration with George Floyd, things died down a bit as far as protests. Again, now we're seeing we're practically hearing about another minority being killed by police almost on a daily basis. Give me your take as far as what's going on over there, and from a journalist's perspective, what's being said.
Well, that's right. I think what's being right now is a natural consequence of the fact that last summer, when hundreds of thousands, millions actually, came out to protest racist police terror in the United States. Arguably the largest protests that have ever taken place in the U.S. In terms of just the total participation. Nothing really fundamentally changed. You know, we forget that, Trump is out of office now. I think there's this tendency among certain more liberal sort of segments to think, well, you know, Biden is in office, things are going to get better. And what we're seeing right now is effectively, it doesn't matter if it's Trump or Biden in the White House, the extrajudicial police killings continue unabated and have, if anything, in the past week, seemed to really accelerate. So that's why you're seeing protests all over the country in cities like Sacramento, especially in Chicago, where Adam Toledo, the 13-year-old boy, was killed by, and in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, where Dante Wright was killed by police just weeks ago, over $346 in unpaid fines. So, you know, what we're seeing here in D.C. Is a similar dynamic, effectively, this lingering sort of police brutality that was never really in any way addressed is now manifesting itself. So last night we saw officers bull rush demonstrators outside the Chinatown Arch in Washington, D.C. around 11:30 as the demonstrators were attempting to disperse. Cops moved in extremely aggressively, shoving protesters to the ground, hurling a woman to the ground, beating on protesters with batons.
Okay.
Extremely aggressive, violent tactics. And we're seeing that play out in other cities, in Brooklyn Center, Minneapolis,
Stay with me. Let me get Dr. Frazier in on this discussion. Dr. Frazier, why are American cops so aggressive? I mean, in many other countries, police try to de-escalate a situation, but in the U.S., it's not rare that a person who's been stopped for a minor traffic violation could end up being violently arrested or killed, especially if that person is a minority and especially Black American.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right, and I want to say that it's actually in the core of the policing within this country. I appreciate your asking me to be on. We have to understand how this police state evolved. And of course, we know for us as Black people, it's evolved since inception, since we've been here in this United States as the police officers being slave catchers. So as a result of that, that is in the very core of the Gestapo state, because what the individuals, and for more or less, they are on this, they have this mindset to shoot to kill. And I think about the mayor that we used to have years ago named Mayor Richard Daley when Dr. King was assassinated. Those were his words. He said, shoot to kill. So that's the way they've been trained. And because of people, you know, Blacks in particular, because the vitriol and the hatred towards Blacks are so escalated within this country that their lives mean nothing. Black lives mean nothing to those who are in power, as well as those who are on the police force. And of course, I'm grateful for the ones who are decent, but there are far too many who are rogue, who have been able to shroud underneath the cloth of being here to protect and serve. Some of them, I would venture to say, are on the police force because they wanted to have the opportunity to kill some Blacks. And because of the fears that they now have had, because people are rising up against this oppression, now different things are happening, and so you see so many individuals are getting wantonly killed on a regular basis.
Now, Dr. Frazier, staying with you, you know, it's been 30 years since Rodney King, and that happened in the Los Angeles of the courts. That was one of the first videos probably that was out and showing police abusing a Black man in that way. What has changed in the United States since Rodney King, 1991, and now we're talking about 2021?
I hate to say that nothing's changed. As a matter of fact, in some cases, rather grew worse. And because of the fact that it's not being judged, it's not being judged from those who are in high positions. They give lip service I'll just do as an aside, you know, when we had the situation where some of the Asians had been jumped on because of the so-called COVID and all of that, of course, the president and the vice president scurried to make sure that they went down to Texas or wherever the situation transpired to comfort and executive orders being issued. However, as it pertains to black people, there has not been an executive order against violence relative to black people. So it's quite obvious that we are not on their agenda. That's the reason why you see so many individuals rising up and contending with those powers, because we know that it's wicked and it's unjust. And so this is what we're seeing. It's in many cases, as I said previously, it has not gotten better, but rather has grown worse.
Well, Wyatt, I've seen many situations that, as a black American, it's quite unbelievable when a white person has been aggressive with police, and yet police wouldn't even draw their guns. I mean, what do you make of this?
Well, that's right. A lot of people are pointing out the obvious. Where was all this energy on January 6th? Where was all of this when the president incited a riot at the Capitol, attempting to essentially prevent the replacement from coming to power? The police handled them with kid gloves. There were very few arrests relative to the numbers at the time. And indeed, footage was released showing cops holding some of the rioters' hands and guiding them into the building, opening doors for them, inviting them in. So I think there is, you know, a lot to be said about that dynamic. And I think it's a natural outgrowth of, as the guest was stating, sort of the history of the United States as a settler colony, as a society which grants rights and privileges based on race and based on this sort of totem pole of racialization, which it invented specifically to exploit black labor, exploit black people, and, you know, on territory which was itself stolen from the native population. All of this goes really to the core, I think, of the police killing issue in the United States and racial justice issues more broadly.
Dr. Frazier, as a race, do you think black Americans suffer from PTSD? I mean, is there added stress on black Americans just living in the United States?
Oh, wow. That's an understatement. Sustained trauma since we've been here. And unfortunately, we are not classified as a people for having suffered PTSD. People pass over that quite often. As a matter of fact, we're not recognized as far as any particulars relative to health, mental health related things and services that's needed. PTSD is extreme in our communities, and the mental health disorders and challenges that have gone undetected, all of the various things that now physically are playing out in individuals' bodies, whether it be genetic disorders and diseases that have come from the sustained and pervasive and perpetual intimidation and all types of things that you can experience or imagine that can be done to a human being. And so, yes, PTSD is very extreme, and our young people in particular are going through PTSD exponentially because they don't see themselves being protected and they don't see others caring about them. And so as a result, you see the escalation of violence and all of these things that people, and I would have to say white supremacists and those who are like them, want to negate and say that this is just something that we need to just get over. But the reality is it's not something that's just going to disappear until it's addressed here in this country.
Well, Dr. Frazier, staying with you, I was just reading something today, actually, and it was talking about professional black individuals and saying that we should not think that this is something that's affecting a certain age group or certain sex in black American, that people who are extremely successful, they'll have that added pressure of being a black American, having to be better than the rest, also having to be an example for their own race. I want to talk about that side of things when we're talking about pressure in general that's on black people in that society.
Well, you know, the truth is, what you said is absolutely right, Sister Marzia. The bottom line is that all of us, no one is exempted from this. As a matter of fact, we, and when I say we, I'm saying myself along with others who have been pushing legislation to proclaim health violence as a health care crisis, in particular for Black people. And so in the state of Illinois, which was it was pushed by Pastor Anthony Williams and those of us who supported that, it's still sitting on the governor's desk. Now, of course, we know that PTSD impacts all of us. There is no Black person that's exempted from PTSD. However, I will say we do have resilience. And as a result of the resilience, we have overcome in so many areas because of the resilience. But that in no wise negates the fact that Black people in general are impacted by PTSD. And then to add to that, how other people benefit from this particular state that we are in relative to PTSD. They benefit from this. And so as a result, we have to endure many things. And as you well know, we have had to and continue. So yes, whether it be a Black physician, a bus driver, you name it, we are impacted by PTSD. And it is an extreme situation here in this country. So definitely, I wholeheartedly agree with what you just said. It is absolutely correct.
Well, Wyatt, we've seen decades and decades of police brutality in the United States, and we've seen protests, people taking to the streets. And what has happened? I mean, we've been looking at this for forever. So what has happened that still we see the same things are taking place? I mean, people have protested and demanded a change, and yet this continues to happen.
Well, what we've seen is continuation of policies that are bipartisan, which is the response to any protest against the police is essentially to give more money to the police, to things they call training. You know, it doesn't seem to be working, right? To me, it's reminiscent of kind of a longstanding pattern among a lot of police apologists who have said, essentially, you know, we just need one more little reform, and then all of a sudden this system will no longer kill Black people almost on a daily basis. And so we saw, you know, in the aftermath of Mike Brown, you know, in the mid 2014-2015, we saw a lot of to-do about, you know, body cameras. Everyone was saying, well, you know, if the officer had been wearing a body camera, then, you know, we would know what happened. We had body cameras started out, police departments all across the country. And we've seen a shift into, you know, well, maybe cops should be equipped with tasers so they have less lethal options, as they like to refer to them. Well, that doesn't seem to be solving. And there have been over a dozen cases where cops have pulled out their gun, claiming that they were reaching for the taser, and shot and killed somebody. So, you know, I think really what has changed is very little. And this is why you continue to hear protesters calling to defund the police, because as the previous guest was stating, there is a massive levels of PTSD, especially in Black communities, in colonized and racialized communities, in working communities more generally. And, you know, part of the reason is all the money goes to the police. The protesters are calling to defund police, put money into mental health, social services, schools, transportation, education, all of the things that prevent violence, you know, in a much more meaningful way than the police.
Okay. Well, Dr. Frazier, if this is the result of systemic racism, does it mean basically that the system has to change, that that's the only way that this is going to be eradicated, that the changes cannot come from within the same system?
As a matter of fact, the whole system has to be reconstructed altogether. As a matter of fact, there are a group of individuals that, you know, we of course work with. They're talking about we're talking about setting up our own place, our own space, so that we can live in peace. If I can say about the police, we have to keep in mind that the police, that whole section had been structured to incite fear in the hearts of Black people. So now we know from slavery even to this point that they're still trying to incite fear. And then, of course, with the gun, so-called gun control, where they say turn in your weapons and all of those things, they're telling individuals to turn in their weapons, but they still have theirs, okay? And wisdom would say is that would you turn in your weapons if you got to take care of your family if some wild vigilante or rogue cop or whoever that is coming to destroy your family? So we have some very deep-seated things here, and it's not just going to disappear. And those people who are supposed to be of goodwill, they are never going to say anything that's going to apparently upheave anything that they believe is going to impact their families. So when we talk about this whole thing, the structure is altogether messed up. The structure has always been messed up. And we understand as Black people that it has never been, the structure has never been set up for us. We're not a part of the structure. This is the reason why you have all of the white supremacists and all of the different ones, the white church and all of the different ones still holding on to some demonic mindset that we're supposed to be in subjection.
So let me just really quickly. So are you saying then that the key, I just want to understand what you're saying. Are you saying basically the key in your perspective is separation? Black Americans separating from
the United States. That is definitely what we've been having that on the table for a good while. We have the reparations movement, but then we also have the separation with the Afro-descendant nation and all of that. They're saying, hey, we got to separate from these people because obviously it's not in their will to do what's righteous. And so we have many things on the table now that we're trying to address on so many different levels.
All right. Thanks so much, Dr. Frazier. Hopefully we'll talk another time in more detail. Appreciate you being with us. Dr. Gail Frazier, author, lecturer, and social entrepreneur. Out of Chicago, White Reed, correspondent out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Gifted and Safi, Ramadan Mubarak, Holy Records.
Ramadan Mubarak, Likulli Muslim, Shahr al-Ladhi fiha, Yunazil al-Qur'an. Happy Ramadan to all Muslims, all the Qur'an be saved in this holy month.
Insights into the Holy Quran, a special program for the holy month of Ramadan.
Welcome you, O holy month of blessings. You are seeking nearness to my Creator, for you my soul and heart has been purified.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. This is a special program for the holy month of Ramadan. In today's program, Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi explains some verses related to this blessed month. Please stay with us.
O month of mercy, you bring so much good. We pray that it never ends, but we know you gotta go as the seasons come and go, cause your time is set by Allah. Oh Ramadan, oh Ramadan, you're the month of the noble Quran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. We're going to be with you in this holy month of Ramadan, talking about the different verses of the Holy Quran regarding the benefits of fasting, the most important of them, piety or taqwa. We'll be with you again after you have listened to some verses of the Holy Quran regarding fasting.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, be especially merciful. O you who have believed, decreed upon you is fasting as it was decreed upon those before you, that you may become righteous.
Brothers and sisters, with regard to this verse of the Holy Quran, وَاسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ وَإِنَّهَا لَكَبِيرَةٌ إِلَّا عَلَى الْخَاشِعِينَ, which is the 45th verse of chapter Baqarah, we mentioned that some traditions have interpreted the word patience, sabr, in this verse, as fasting. So fasting can be counted as the beginning journey of the wayfarer towards the Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We also concluded that all the divine revelations have occurred during the month of Ramadan or during fasting. For example, the entire Quran was revealed to the Prophet of Islam in the holiest night of the holiest month of Ramadan. With regard to this, we raised the question about the relationship between the revelations and fasting. In answer to this question, we started talking about the benefits of fasting. We talked about physical healing and physical aspect of fasting. And now we can move on to social healing. With regard to this, there is a verse in the Holy Quran in chapter Yunus, the 44th verse. The Holy Quran says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يَظْلِمُ النَّاسَ شَيْئًا وَلَكِنَّ النَّاسَ أَنفُسَهُمْ يَظْلِمُونَ. Truly, Allah wrongs not mankind in aught, but mankind wrong themselves.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
شهر رمضان الذي أنزل فيه القرآن هدى للناس وبينات من الهدى والفرقان فمن شهد منكم الشهر فليصم ومن كان مريضا أو على سفر فعدة من أيام أخر يريد الله بكم اليسر ولا يريد بكم العسر ولتكملوا العدة ولتكبروا الله على ما هداكم ولعلكم تشكرون.
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it. And whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which He has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
A man wrote a letter to Imam Askari alayhi salam, asking him for what reason did Allah make fasting compulsory? Imam alayhi salam wrote in reply, God has made fasting compulsory so that the rich shall find the pain of hunger, so they have mercy upon the poor as well. And this is the most important social aspect of fasting, because starvation and its related diseases causes one person per second to die on this planet. You have heard the stories involving deaths in Africa. Although the rates are high, but we have lesser coverage than other happenings and events in the universe. Anyway, what I want to mention is that the biggest problem facing the people, the humanity today, is not the people dying in the streets of poor countries. It is rather that lack of sense of caring for those disadvantaged people whose rights have been usurped by others. Fasting
provides the opportunity for the faster to feel and find for himself or herself the pain and agony that the poor person is going through. A fasting person can keep his or her money, usually spent on lunch, and can send it afterwards to food a group of poor people. And that is one of the reasons Zakatul Fitra is compulsory and is regarded as the compilation of fasting. Some fasters sleep during the day as much as they can to avoid the so-called pains of fasting. But what they are actually doing, in fact, is they are losing the entire medical and social and spiritual benefits of it, because they sleep as much as they can to avoid the pains, and upon sunset enjoy a feast greedily, and that's why they lose the benefits of fasting. Of course, all these things being said, one of the most important aspects that actually require a set of different programs to talk about is the reduction of crimes that happen during the month of Ramadan. This can be counted as one of the most important factors the societies, the communities, and the governments must care. And this reduction of crimes is counted as another social benefit of fasting, but we're not going to talk about it in details. Anyway, we have mentioned two aspects of benefits of fasting. One is physical, the other social, but we believe the main benefits of religious fasting are its spiritual healing, or its spiritual rejuvenation, which we will talk about in the next program. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to us. If you have any question or comment, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at farstoday.com. May Allah accept your deeds in this holy month of Ramadan, and please include all Muslims in your prayers. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Forgive us and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
سبحان الله والحمد لله لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر لا إله إلا الله.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah.
سبحان الله
Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. In this segment of the show, The Months of Allah, we're going to talk about some famous reciters of the Quran. One of them is Sheikh Muhammad Abdul Aziz Hassan. He is an Egyptian reciter. He was born in 1928 in Gharbiya Governorate of Egypt. Sheikh Muhammad Abdul Aziz Hassan memorized the Holy Quran when he was a child, just like many other Egyptian reciters. He was a blind reciter of the Quran, but he was so gifted and talented in using the maqamat as well as waqf wal-ibtida that he was known as Malikul Waqf wal-ibtida. Okay, waqf wal-ibtida means the places of the verses of the Holy Quran where you can stop and places you can continue. It's the science of waqf wal-ibtida. His use of maqamat was spectacular. He used all of the maqamat in his recitations and very skillfully, because, you know, some reciters, they have a very good voice, they have a very beautiful, silky, smooth voice, but their use of maqamat and alhan in a sophisticated way. Sheikh Muhammad Abdul Aziz Hassan had both a very good voice, beautiful voice, and also he used the maqamat very artistically. At first, he was a follower of the style of Sheikh Mustafa Ismail, but later he developed his own style. The recitation that we're going to listen to today is Surah Yusuf. It's about the verses of the story of Prophet Yusuf and Zulaykha. وَرَاوَدَتْهُ الَّتِي هُوَ فِي بَيْتِهَا. From the beginning of this verse until the end of this verse. Sheikh Muhammad Abdul Aziz Hassan was very skillful in conveying the meanings of the verses of the Holy Quran through his voice, intonation, and the melodies that he used. In this recitation, he uses both the low register of his voice and the highest register of his voice, the qarar and jawab and jawab al-jawab. He uses the highest register of his voice. You know, by highest register, we mean that his voice is so high-pitched and so high that He can't recite in a higher pitch. Okay, this is called Jawabul Jawab. Because, you know, this is the climax of the story of Prophet Yusuf. It's where Prophet Yusuf goes into the house of the wife of the Pharaoh, and then she traps him in her room. And then, you know, the things that happen next. Sheikh Muhammad Abdul Aziz Hassan uses Jawab al-Jawab to show that this is the climax of the story. Now, with this explanation, let's go ahead and listen to Surah Yusuf, verses 22 to 24, by Sheikh Muhammad Abdul Aziz Hassan.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم فلما بلغ أشده
When Joseph reached maturity, we gave him judgment and knowledge, and thus we reward the doers of good. And she, in whose house he was, sought to seduce him. She closed the doors and said, "Come, you." He said, "I seek the refuge of Allah. Indeed, he is my master, who has made good my residence. Indeed, wrongdoers will not succeed." And she certainly determined to seduce him. And he would have inclined to her had he not seen the proof of his Lord. And thus it was that we should avert from him evil and immorality. Indeed, he was of our chosen servants.
The World with Reporters.
The seventh holy month of Ramadan since the start of the war on Yemen has arrived, and Yemeni's struggle continues. The rising cost of living makes shopping for essentials a difficult task, as most Yemenis depend on daily wages.
We're going through a harsh economic condition. The ongoing blockade and war imposed by the Saudi-led coalition have put us in deep troubles. We hardly earn our livelihood and can't afford to buy food for Ramadan.
Tradesmen say they didn't earn much this year due to severe fuel crisis that led to the rising of prices of foodstuffs. Meanwhile, deteriorating economic condition has forced many companies to discharge thousands of their employees.
The purchasing power of people in Yemen has weakened significantly. The prices are rising because the Saudi-led coalition is still preventing entry of oil ships to Yemen. We are suffering greatly from the ongoing war and blockade.
Yemen is on the brink of famine and facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations, since Saudi-led coalition backed by Washington launched a devastating war on the war-ravaged nation at the beginning of 2015.
Despite the tragic humanitarian situation in their country, Yemenis welcome Ramadan with hopes of an end to war. They say their army's escalation of retaliatory attacks is pushing Riyadh further into a political solution. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنع.
The United Arab Emirates has sparked anger among Palestinians by congratulating Israel on its so-called Independence Day, declared in 1948. The occasion is marked by Palestinians as the beginning of their displacement from their homeland. They view the day as the Nakba or Catastrophe Day.
What Israelis are marking is the day of our catastrophe, the day Palestinians were slaughtered by Zionist gangs. Hundreds of thousands of them were displaced from their homes and lands. The UAE should have sent a message to condemn the daily crimes and oppression committed by the Israeli soldiers as settlers against the Palestinians.
The UAE Embassy in Tel Aviv published a tweet wishing a happy Independence Day to the citizens of Israel, posting a photo of the Israeli and Emirati flags side by side. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu replied by thanking the UAE.
The UAE has not only normalized ties with Israel, but also raised the ties to a new level. The UAE is also becoming Israel's partner in its aggression against the Palestinian people. The congratulation message comes as Israel is preventing Palestinians from entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The UAE was among the first Arab countries to agree to normalize ties with Israel in 2020 under the so-called Abraham Accords, a pact brokered by former U.S. President Donald Trump. Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan signed normalization deals with the Israeli regime shortly afterwards. Palestinians have angrily slammed normalization of ties between Israel and Arab states, including UAE. They say that since then, those states have been continuing to reward the regime and giving up the Holy Lands. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Iran's lead nuclear negotiator in Vienna, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says a new understanding is being reached amid attempts to revive the Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Following a joint commission session with JCPOA signatories, Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, Araghchi said negotiators can now start working on a common draft.
Drafting can begin at least in the areas where the sides share the same views. For that purpose, the Iranian delegation has prepared its drafts both on the nuclear measures and sanction lifting, and has presented its drafts to the other parties. And we believe these texts can form the basis for negotiations and a final agreement.
Although the nuclear measures that Iran needs to take to come back to full compliance are clear, there is less clarity when it comes to the list of U.S. sanctions that need to be removed.
China maintained that all U.S. sanctions should be lifted immediately. May it concern sanctions against Iran or its long-term jurisdiction measures affecting third country entities and individuals, including those on Chinese. So we are looking forward to such a drafting exercise.
Iran has remained steadfast in its position that it will only act after verifying the U.S.'s removal of all the sanctions, including those imposed additionally or relabeled under former President Donald Trump. Although there have been no direct talks between Iran and the U.S., American delegates in Vienna have been engaged in talks with the EU coordinator and the other JCPOA signatories. Iran's lead delegate says there are still some serious differences that need to be worked out. For now, the expert working groups have been tasked with engaging in more substantive work for the next few days. Homolesky, Vienna.
Exchanging accusations, disagreements, and threats. This is how Turkey and Greece relation has been going for decades, and it seems that this is how it will continue, despite the trials to solve the problems through dialogue. The two countries have always been at loggerheads due to several factors, such as history, disputes on border, politics, culture, and lately, interests and power. Not to mention the refugee crisis, which added to the pile of disputes, as well as the latest maritime conflict. During a visit that is the first since the heated dispute that rose in 2020 between the two neighbors over Turkey sending a search vessel into East Mediterranean, foreign ministers of both countries exchanged accusations. The press conference started with a welcoming speech for Turkish foreign minister to holding this dialogue in hope to search solutions for the differences between Ankara and Athens. However, the Greek minister took advantage of this opportunity to criticize Turkey's actions in Eastern Mediterranean and accuse Ankara of not abiding by the refugee deal made with Brussels, which forced Mevlut Çavuşoğlu to respond.
If you heavily accuse my country and people before the press, I have to be in a position to respond to that. If you want to continue our tensions, we can. If we go into mutual recriminations here, we have a lot to tell each other.
For his turn, Nikos Dendias, the Greek foreign minister, accused Turkey of not abiding by the deal made in 2016 with the EU, adding Turkey should not try to teach Greece lessons.
What's happened during the press conference after the meeting between Turkish and Greek foreign ministers was very unfortunate, but this is the actual illustration of the relation between the two. Many believe that there is no chance for reaching a solution. Today, a meeting between Cyprus, Greece, Israel and the UAE will take place. However, Egypt won't participate in this meeting. Turkey won't hesitate to respond if the outcome of this meeting wasn't up to Ankara's expectations, and I don't think the response will only be verbal.
In 2020, Turkey showed goodwill by pulling its search vessel Oruç Reis from Eastern Mediterranean in hope that dialogue between Ankara and Athens would reach a common ground. The conflict between Turkey and Greece is too profound to be solved in few meetings. Analysts believe the two must put those differences aside if they plan to reach a solution, or else the conflict will worsen. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
There is no letter to the protest to compel Pakistani government to expel French ambassador from the country. At the heart of current wave of angry protest is government's decision to shelve its 5 months old agreement with Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, or TLP, a religious and political party, to expel the French ambassador to Islamabad. The repeated incidents of publications of blasphemous cartoons of Islam's Prophet Muhammad and official patronage of France to unending incident of blasphemy has once again triggered a mass unrest in Pakistan starting early this week. The security forces came down hard onto the protesters and managed to clear most of the highways they had occupied across Pakistan a few days ago. Paris has advised all of its citizens to immediately leave Pakistan over security concern to their lives. Pakistan has restored services of major platforms on social media networks after temporarily suspending them to contain the violence. The religious group claims that over two dozens of its supporters were killed by security forces, while hundreds of others were injured and arrested. The government says nearly 600 of its policemen were injured and four of them were killed in the clashes. Pakistan has described the current wave of violence as an act of terrorism and banned the TLP.
We tried our level best through dialogue to avoid crisis from getting aggravated. However, subsequently, we found that they had a dangerous plan to cause the unrest in Pakistan. After banning the TLP, we will soon petition with the Supreme Court as part of our legal formality to get the TLP dissolved.
Pakistan's major political parties have history of attacking security forces and key state-owned buildings, some of them at far greater scale than that of TLP. The frequent incidents of blasphemy in the West has led to make TLP as one of the leading political forces in Pakistan. It is a well-entrenched and enjoys street power, and on one of the occasions late last year, it attracted millions of people in the eastern city of Lahore. Therefore, analysts believe that the government's decision to ban TLP is most likely to backfire, given the fact that TLP has extensively exploited the most sensitive public issue linked with the honor of the Prophet of Islam. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
On the occasion of Palestinian Prisoners' Day that marks April 17th of each year, Palestinian Prisoners' Committee in the Gaza Strip held a protest in front of the oldest prisoner's house, Diya al-Agha, who spent 29 years in Israeli jails. This protest aimed to express solidarity and support to all Palestinian prisoners who suffer in Israeli jails.
We hope Palestinian prisoners return home soon, and we wish there is a swap deal that can free all the Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. They are our heroes, and we are proud of them. My only dream is just to see my son Diya again.
Nowadays, there are around 4,400 Palestinian detainees inside Israeli prisons. Most of them are suffering from different kinds of policies that aims to break the Palestinian detainees' will. The main policies practiced against them nowadays is medical negligence. This policy practiced against them since the beginning of the Israeli occupation. This policy caused more than 70 Palestinian martyrs killed through this policies inside Israeli prisons.
As part of the series of events held to mark Palestinian Prisoners' Day, the Palestinian Legislative Council held a press conference to renew the vow to set all the prisoners free from the Israeli jails and follow the steps of resistance.
Palestinians will free all prisoners who sacrificed their lives. We are following the footsteps of the prisoners, and their freedom is one of our major priorities. Israeli occupation won't see peace as long as our prisoners are suffering from the Israeli policies inside the jails.
There are some thousands of Palestinians in Israeli jails, including women and children.
On the Palestinian Prisoners' Day, people here stress that the prisoners are the symbol of the Palestinian cause, and their issue is a priority, as the resistance wants it idle until all Palestinian prisoners are free. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Nearly all British troops will be withdrawn from Afghanistan following the US President Joe Biden's announcement that US forces would leave before this year's 20th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks.
We went to Afghanistan because of a horrific attack that happened 20 years ago. That cannot explain why we should remain there in 2021.
Over 100,000 Afghan civilians, 454 British troops, and 2,488 American troops have been killed. It cost the British taxpayer over £37 billion and the US taxpayer a whopping $2.4 trillion. It's lasted longer than both world wars combined and ranks as the US's longest ever war. But what's actually been achieved? The Taliban, which they fought so hard to oust, are poised to return to power and control most of the country. Takfiri terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda are still present, and new groups like Daesh have emerged. Moreover, Afghanistan now accounts for 93% of the world's illicit heroin supply, with heroin production reaching its record levels in 2017.
spoke to Lindsay German, who was at the forefront of the British anti-war movement.